to iloverealestate.tv. My name's Dimna Boholt, and what we're going to be talking about today is something that is a topic nobody likes to talk about. But it's one of those topics that, you know, everybody has to talk about, because at some stage, you know what? It's going to happen to all of us. What am I talking about? I'm talking about death. Boring topic. Well, morbid topic more than boring. I think there's actually some interesting things to come out of the discussion today. But I think it's so important that we need to discuss it, and it's something we need to put in place. And of course, what I'm talking about now is wills. No matter what situation you're in, everybody needs to be having a will. It's something as part of growing wealth and building portfolios and, you know, getting yourself to a position where, you know, you have resources and things behind you, then the concept of what's going to happen when you're no longer around does need to be talked about, particularly if you have family and children that you want to pass on your wealth to. A lot of the reasons why people go out and actually, gain great wealth is because they want to start a legacy and to build up a decent-sized empire for their descendants. But unfortunately, I see a lot of the situations where, you know, a lot of time and effort is put into building up the wealth, but then a will is not put in place. And, you know, the whole thing comes crumbling down like a house of cards simply because they haven't given enough thought to what happens when they pass on. And how does the empire continue on? So to help me out today, I have Derek Skye here to help me talk about wills and enduring powers of attorney and death and all of that kind of stuff. One of your favourite topics, is it not?
Oh, it's all the fun stuff, Dimna, isn't it? It's the exciting things that people love to deal with. So I know that wills and dealing with that sort of thing is something that people hate to do. It's always one of the things that gets put off. It's not fun. It doesn't make you money. It's just a roadblock in the way of getting on with things. And it's a very important thing to deal with, as you say, but it's definitely something that people put off till last to deal with, of all their items on their checklist of getting things sorted out from year to year.
You must see a lot of people who have put it off, and then they, you know, they get the scare or they get the call from the doctor saying you've got to get your affairs in place because they've got a terminal illness or something like that, and then everything becomes a mad rush to effectively beat the clock.
Yeah, look, unfortunately that is all too common. There's two things that seem to prompt people to get their wills done very quickly, and one is a terminal illness, which is obviously very sad when that happens. And unfortunately, we don't always have a lot of time in those circumstances to do things as completely as we might like. And one of my older files for where we struck that problem was a lady who was terminally ill, and we only had a couple of weeks before she passed away. And unfortunately, in her circumstances, we weren't able to change everything to do with her estate because of her particular superannuation fund. In that case, was a problem. It took a long time to try and deal with that. And her estranged husband, who she'd separated from some 10 years earlier, was able to receive a benefit from the superannuation fund because we just didn't have time to deal with it properly.
Wow.
If she'd had a chance to deal with that properly, she could have passed a little bit more money on to her six children, who probably could have used it a lot better than that horrible so-and-so she'd tried to leave behind so many years ago. But yeah, it's the terminal illness is one of the things that prompts people to do it, and the other one is people coming in and telling me they're about to head off on a great overseas holiday next week, which is obviously a lot more fun for people, and makes me a lot more jealous in those circumstances when they leave me behind to get all this paperwork sorted out for them.
And divorce would have to be up there on the list too, wouldn't it?
Unfortunately, it's not as much of a prompt for people. It really should be. You spot on the money, because things like a divorce will, depending on the jurisdiction, either terminate the will or terminate gifts in favour of your now ex-spouse, but the separation doesn't. And so if you separate from someone, and you should really, as a priority, deal with your will very quickly in a very complete manner, but unfortunately it doesn't result in as many people attending to it quickly as it should. They seem to be too busy sticking pins into the voodoo doll of their ex and consulting with their family lawyer, which is obviously very important as well, not so much the voodoo doll. maybe I should be offering free voodoo dolls with wills. I'm making a note of that as we speak.
Right.
But it's one thing...
Typical callous lawyer.
Yeah, that's it. But even when people decide to attend to it, the other thing I notice is that they come in and have their first appointment with me and then think, oh, what a relief. I've done that now. And I then have to try and hustle them to get back in to actually sign things up and finalise it because they think the hard work's been done. But look, it's not a
present. There's a lot of thought that goes into a will, though, because, you know, even looking at myself, I've got a number of children. And, you know, it's a fair swag of property. And it's like, what do you do?
Yeah.
Who do you leave what to? Because some of them have, you know, obviously they're all your children, but some of them are more capable of handling some things than others.
Yeah, look, and that's a really good point. It can involve a lot of decisions that are really difficult. And a lot of people put it off because they're worried about making these decisions or worried about how they're going to make those decisions. And really part of the lawyer's job is trying to simplify that process and highlight some of the issues. And sometimes I describe my job as throwing spanners into the works to see what I can gum up, because people come in thinking, yes, I've sorted this out, I've thought about it all, and we know exactly what we want, and then I start throwing the spanners and seeing if I can gum up the works.
Mm-hmm.
And put questions to them about, you know, well, what about this circumstance or what about that circumstance? And it does make it more difficult in the shorter term, but ultimately it'll make it simpler once they've considered all
those
things.
Better in the long term.
Yeah.
So what about personal items? I mean, what do you say to people? You know, they want to leave this ring to that child or that piece of whatever more memorabilia stuff. Do you get people to go and make a list of that kind of stuff, or what do you do?
Yeah, it varies, and some people want to deal with it in more formal ways than others. And so I have had a client who made a list of items that he wanted to leave to various people, which was about 3 or 4 pages long in the will, and the costs of the will reflected the fact that I had to
type out
an extra 3 or 4 pages of items and make sure it was properly recorded.
He could have given you the digital version, could have cut and paste.
It could have done. He was an elderly gentleman who was much better with computers than I was, I must admit. He was the first person to explain Skype to me all those years ago. But it was a long list. But for him it was very important because there was a lot of very significant artworks that he'd collected from all over the world. Sculptures, paintings, all sorts of things, and he was a very educated man about those items, and he knew what he wanted, he knew where they were to go, and he had a large family to leave them to. And so that was okay. For him it was worthwhile going to that length. Another example is my own grandmother, who didn't put any of that in her will, but when we turned up to her house, actually for her wake, we noticed that behind all the items of furniture there were stickers, and you know there was a bookcase with Derek written on it, and so that's
really?
When I knew I got a bookcase from my grandmother, which was lovely. But that's another way of dealing with things, perhaps not so much the stickers on the back of items, but informally you can make a list of different items, you can leave it with your affairs. It won't be legally binding, and in fact we might try very hard to make sure it's not legally binding so that it doesn't cause any difficulties in getting probate on a will. But it can give your executors a guide to what goes
should
where.
Happen, yeah. What you want to happen, yeah.
And they can use their discretion to make sure it happens, because oftentimes families all over the country or all over the world, they don't want to take a bookcase back to London.
No.
They're probably happy to leave that to a niece or nephew who's nearby, even though they might not technically be a beneficiary under the will.
So what does it cost to do a will?
Rough cost, look, it does vary depending on exactly what we're doing, but to give a ballpark cost, you know, I think it's fair to say that most lawyers that are doing a decent job of things, for a very simple will for a couple with powers of attorney, might be charging $1,000 to $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
For a testamentary discretionary trust will, which is a more complex arrangement, but again...
Particularly important if you've got young children.
Yeah, particularly important with young children and larger estates, and by that I mean sort of $500,000 upwards, might cost $2,000,
$2,500.
There are a lot of variables in those sorts of things, so that's just as a rough guide.
Okay, so I've heard of scenarios where you've got places like the public trustee and those sort of places where they'll do the will for free.
Yes, I've heard of law firms and public trustees that'll do it for free.
What's the catch?
The catch is usually that you appoint them as executors of your will, and then they will be very enthusiastic in the fees that they charge at that end of the process. They're trying to build up a value in goodwill in their business and using your will as a...
So basically they get paid significantly to manage your estate at the other end, and they take fees out of your estate.
That's right. Yeah. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
No. This actually happened to my brother-in-law's mother, who died, and she had the public trustee. And they had one house in a small country town. It was probably worth, I don't know, $200,000. And the lawyers charged $20,000 to administer this sale of one house. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, a lawyer that I know who used to work for one of the public trustee authorities around the great country of Australia, I won't be too specific, he said that he was involved in a matter where there was one item of real estate and the legal fees were $70,000
wow.
to administer it. And that sort of fee makes lawyers look cheap, which is quite a feat to achieve. Because the costs of administering that estate, you know, in that particular example for us, might have been more like $4,000 or $5,000.
Yeah.
So a lot cheaper. And when lawyers are a lot cheaper, you know that there's something going on.
Talking of cheap, what about the legal will kits and things like that that you can buy at the news agency? What's your take on them?
Oh, look, as somebody that also does estate disputes, I'm a big fan of them because they very often lead to those disputes. In all seriousness, the issues to do with wills are, look, you can try and do it yourself, but you're going to miss something most likely. Mm. There's a lot of complexity in wills. It's a specialist area of law, and there's a reason for that. There's lots of things to consider. In drafting the will and making sure that it's correct, that's one thing. But these days there's also a lot of assets that won't be governed by wills that you need to consider, and that might not be caught up in the process. So things like superannuation, life insurance, joint tenant and property, which is usually the family home, that sort of thing, are not going to be covered by your will necessarily, but they're part of that whole process.
Or trust assets.
Yeah, trust assets, absolutely. So people that are investing through trusts, you can say, I give my assets to X, Y and Z, but you're not going to govern trust assets in that process.
Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of formality, I suppose, about producing a will, even the way it's signed and what colour pen and all of this kind of rot, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The colour of pen has gotten a little bit more flexible over time. And there's all sorts of provisions around
witnessing.
The states. Yeah, look, witnessing is a big one, because if a witness to your will is somebody that is a beneficiary under the will, that might invalidate the gift to that person, or it might invalidate the will.
Mm.
And in some states, that includes a lawyer. So in some states, if you have a lawyer witness your will who is appointed as an executor, for example, then it might make that appointment invalid, and you might very well want your trusted family lawyer to be your executor.
Mm.
And so there's sometimes little tricks and traps that can catch up even the experienced people in the legal industry. So there's lots of things to pay attention to. These days, a lot of the problems that we see are that there's a trend towards recognising what we call informal wills, so that you can make an application to the court to say, look, this particular document doesn't meet the technical definition of a will, but it was intended to be a will, so it should be recognised.
Mm.
And there's documents that it's not crystal clear whether this was actually intended to be a will, and it might just be some preliminary notes, or it might be an idea for an estate plan that is dependent entirely upon some conditions being met. You know, re-establishing contact with an estranged child or something like that. And so it might not be meant to be a will, but it looks like it, and the people left behind aren't certain. And sometimes it's notes on a will. We've seen a few cases recently where people are making handwritten notes on wills, and then we're not sure whether it's the will that's intended to stand or the will with the handwritten notes, and they can be very significant.
And does that go to court?
Yeah, it does go to court. So generally speaking, there's an obligation on lawyers that are involved. And the obligation's actually on executors, but it's the lawyers that are obviously the ones that catch these little laws or obligations.
Yeah.
To put before the court all the documents that might be testamentary documents. And so it might be something contrary to the interests of the beneficiaries, but there's obligations to put these documents forward. And so sometimes we have to put forward the note that just says, I want my... you know, my best suit to go to my oldest son. That might be a testamentary instrument. And when it's not clear, whenever there's doubt, whenever extra steps have to be taken, one of the big drawbacks is it adds to the costs.
Yeah.
If we have to submit documents to the court and the court wants extra proof about whether it was in fact a testamentary instrument and what the intentions of the parties were, and we're talking to witnesses and taking statements, all of these things are done at hourly rates.
Mm.
And I'm sure everybody's got an opinion about what lawyers' hourly rates are like. They're certainly not something that you want to pay unless you have to.
Tell us the story about, I mean, I know you've told it before, but the story about, you know, the wording and how particular you have to be about things like trustees and executors.
Well, the most recent example of this is with a superannuation death benefit nomination in a case that actually involved one of the founding partners of a law firm that I used to work for. I hasten to add he was a property lawyer and not a very upstanding succession lawyer like myself. So it was slightly outside his area of expertise, but it just goes to show that even people familiar with the technicalities of law can make mistakes. In that case, he made a death benefit nomination which related to his superannuation. And he nominated that the superannuation would be paid to the trustee of his estate. That was the wording he used, rather than the executor of his estate.
And did that make a big difference?
It made all the difference in the world, actually, because instead of it being a valid death benefit nomination, it was an invalid death benefit nomination. So instead of it being binding on the trustee of his superannuation fund, it was only non-binding, which meant that the trustee could take it into her account and then make the decision that she chose.
So who was the trustee?
Well, in this case, it's funny you mentioned that, Dimna, but it was his second wife and the child of his second wife, instead of the children from his first relationship, for example, who were the intended beneficiaries under the nomination he'd made. So he nominated the children from his first relationship. He intended that to be a binding nomination, but it was not a binding nomination. So his second wife and his second wife's daughter got to make a decision about whether they followed that or not. And I'm sure we're all going to be surprised by the result here. No suspense needed. The death benefit nomination was not followed.
So the kids from the first marriage missed out, basically.
Yes.
One of the things that we hear a lot about these days is contesting a will. Mm. And I've been told that when a will is contested, the money in the estate actually pays for the contesting. So it's creating all of these wills to be contested all over the joint.
Yeah, look, that's certainly true. And it was probably more that way, say maybe up to about 4 or 5 years ago. And the courts obviously noticed that was what was happening, that the presumption was that the estate would pay the costs of a disputed estate in all but exceptional cases. If it was an absolutely hopeless case with no chance of success, then a costs order might be made against the person making the claim, which is the general case at law. Usually costs follow the event. The winner of the court case will usually have most of their costs, very rarely all of their costs,
covered,
paid by the other side.
Right.
You never profit from it. You're always out of pocket a little bit when it comes to costs. And in estate disputes, we used to have the opinion that it'll be pretty right. We'll get our costs covered by the estate, so it might be worth a crack. That changed a little bit over the last few years, and the courts are very reluctant to order costs in cases where the estate can't bear it or it's disproportionate costs. And even now, in some cases where people are winning their dispute, if the court considers it's not reasonable because of the amount of the order that they might have received and the size of the estate, they might not get a costs order as well.
Mm.
So there's been a couple of cases where a costs order that it goes against the winning party outweighs their
the benefit.
Award. Yeah. Mm. So they win and then they lose. and some jurisdictions go further where, in New South Wales there's an obligation on lawyers to sign off on the claim being worthwhile, or the lawyer themselves might face a costs order. Which is very motivating when, as a lawyer, we might have to pay it ourselves.
Yeah.
Gosh, that wasn't part of the deal. we're usually playing with clients' money. I'm being tongue-in-cheek there, of course. But we do have to take it seriously and make sure that there is a case there, some basis for making the claim. But generally speaking, it's going to erode the estate, win, lose or draw. That is certainly the rule of thumb.
So how long after the death of a deceased can you challenge a will?
It varies between the states. So it is the sort of thing where there are very strict time limits. So, to be a lawyer for a moment, if there's a chance that you might be challenging an estate you should seek legal advice immediately. But to give indications of rough time frames, it might be 12 months, 15 months, it might be 6 months. In Queensland, that you have to notify an estate that you're going to make a challenge, make the challenge within 9 months. So there's varying rules around the states of Australia, but it's important that you act on it as quickly as possible because you might lose your rights to challenge under the estate.
Now, when we're, you know, discussing wills and this sort of thing, you know, there's a process of putting it in place, but there's also then the process of actually, you know, dealing with everything at the end. So somebody dies. What actually happens? Like, who takes over? Who does what?
Yeah, it's a good question because things can happen almost immediately. In a very practical sense, the first things that happen are funeral arrangements and locking up the family home and securing it. And it's the executor that has the obligation and the right to do that. But when it comes to something like burial arrangements, they can be very personal and it can be an area that's disputed almost immediately with no potential for financial gain for anybody. It's something where big fights can happen.
Like what?
Whether the person's buried or cremated.
Okay.
And I was reading yesterday, so forgive me, I'm not going to be great on the facts of this, but there's been a case where there was a deceased person's body in the morgue for 20 years while there was an
20 age. Years?
It was 10 or 20 years, so a long time. So while they fought out these things, they can be very personal.
What, as to whether you get cremated or buried? Who cares?
Sort of
you're
thing.
Gone.
Yeah, well, it's not much of a drama for the person who's died. And so generally that's
20
one of,
years!
Well, that's one of the things where people often say to me, oh, look, I don't care. Bury me, cremate me, I don't care. And I say, well, even if you have to toss a coin, let's toss the coin now and literally...
Yeah. Make a decision.
Reach into their pocket and grab a coin of theirs. And,
not your own.
That's such a habit for a lawyer. You know, we need to toss a coin. Let's do it now.
Yep.
Because I've been in the situation of deciding it for my father when he passed away.
Yep.
We didn't know what he wanted because in the grand tradition of never buy a mechanic's car, I did not discuss these issues with my father, even though this is what I do for a living. And so we didn't know what he would want. And we had to have a conversation about, you know, what's going to happen. And I can tell you from that personal and also professional experience, the family will agonise over it.
Mm.
It will be a huge deal. What would Dad want? Oh my gosh, let's analyse this to the nth degree, even though the person probably wouldn't care.
Mm.
If you feel strongly, you can put burial directions in your will. It's not binding, but at least you're giving people an indication they won't agonise over it. They'll know what you want if they're looking at your will. The decision is made relatively quickly, of course, which means that somebody may not have had the opportunity to read your will.
Yeah.
It's very hard to uncremate somebody if they've gone to the length of
cremation.
You can bury
the urn.
Yeah. You can bury what's left, but it's very hard to reconstitute the ingredients. Telling people who are going to make that decision while you're alive is a good idea. It doesn't really make for a fun Sunday afternoon barbecue with the family, though.
You were telling me earlier about someone where they put in their will what they wanted and then the wife says, no, that's not going to happen.
Oh, yeah, that happens as well. I've had that with a husband and wife where one wanted burial and one wanted cremation the wife was very strongly against cremation and she said to the husband, I don't care what you say, you're not getting cremated, I'm going to bury you. But a very recent one...
So it's a race for who dies first.
That's exactly what I said. Let's make sure we're eating our vegetables, people, because there's a lot on the line here. But another one was a husband that decided he wanted to be made into a cremation diamond.
What is a cremation diamond?
Look, I did a little bit of research on it because I was interested, but not a lot. They basically take your carcass and cook you under high pressure and make you into a diamond.
How big a diamond?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess it depends on how many pizzas you've had during your lifetime. But
but is it like... big, or you go down to a diamond you put on your ring?
Yeah, you're not going to be a Dimpner-sized diamond. You know, that might be worthwhile if you could do that. But no, it's a smaller diamond. But the process, I think, costs something like $10,000 or $15,000.
And who on earth does that?
Well, the wife looked at the husband and said, I can tell you, if you die, there is no way I'm spending $10,000 or $15,000 on a diamond.
She didn't want to wear him on her finger?
No, she said, I'd rather feed the kids. So she's getting her priorities right in that case. And I put it into his will and he understood that very unlikely to happen. But it was very considerate. He did want the diamond to go to his wife. So
What happens if the beneficiary to something in the will is actually already dead?
That's a really good question, because, and it's something that people don't often think about. That's one of the spanners that I throw and try and gum up the works. So people always have in mind, you know, if I die, I want it to go to the wife or the husband, and if both of us have died, I want it to go to the kids, and that's all, end of the line often. But we have to go further than that, because it might be that the kids have died before you, or you might have a specific gift that you want to go to your brother or sister, but what if they have died as well? So we do have to follow all of these lines to the end and make sure that we think of all of these what ifs. And so you have to think about what I call tragedy beneficiaries, which is what's happened if you and your spouse have died, you've got no surviving kids. Do we pass things down to the grandkids, which is usually the case, but I have had people say, no, I'm here to look after my kids, bugger the grandkids, they're cute and all, but I'm not going to give them any money.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly people want it to go down to the grandkids level. But what if you don't have any surviving children or grandchildren?
Yeah.
Who gets it in that instance? And often when we're dealing with wills, we're dealing with a husband and wife at the same time. And so if one of them has died first, then usually they've given everything to the survivor. And so that survivor is then dealing with all of the assets of their relationship. And if they've died shortly after one another, so within months or a year or so, you might think about it that the surviving spouse is giving away both the assets of themselves and also their spouse that has predeceased them. So they often want to leave assets to their own side of the family and the other side of the family as well.
Mm.
And so you might need to consider, well, is it 50-50? Do we leave it half to each side of the family? Or sometimes, you know, the wife has two siblings and the husband has five and they want them to take it per capita. So each of the seven people gets 1/7 each, even though that means that one side of the family got 5/7 and the other side of the family got 2/7. And sometimes the wife has brought in 90% of the assets of the relationship, so she wants 90% to go to
that can happen with side. Kids from previous marriages too.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. And that sort of thing can be a a challenge, and sometimes it's difficult to come to the right resolution, but it is something that people have to think about.
I remember years ago in the accountancy practice, I had a couple come into me where they were both second marriages. They both had children from previous marriages. They had no children together. And they owned all their assets, you know, in joint names. So they were coming in talking about their will and things, and they were saying, well, I want my share to go to my five kids, and the other one wanted all of her share to go to her one child. And I was looking up there going, you know what? That ain't going to happen.
No, that's another competition to see who lives longest.
That's exactly right, because they owned everything in their own names, which meant that it automatically went to the surviving party, and either side of the family could well have missed out on everything.
Yeah, and this is why it's very important when we're doing wills to really dig down on what the assets are and how they are owned, because you can own a property jointly with somebody, but it could be joint tenants, which is what you're saying, that the property automatically passes to the surviving joint tenant, or it could be a tenancy in common where you have a divisible share. You have a share that you can leave under your will, which will pass as you see fit. And so I've had that same circumstance where people with their own children, but no children together, had a total of 6 properties and they wanted 3 to go to one, 3 to go to the other.
Mm.
But they owned them all jointly as joint tenants, and that was a competition to see who lives
longest. Totally.
So, you know, get all in touch with a personal trainer, eat your veggies, and let's see who can live it out.
Outlive the other.
Yeah.
What happens when, in a will, you know, you might give most of your assets to one child and only a little bit to the other?
Mm.
Is that something that they would automatically win in contesting a will or not?
Well, it's a real length of string argument or question, that one, because it does depend a lot on the circumstances of the case. Often we're seeing that sort of scenario because people might say to me that they've looked after the youngest child all his life. He's hopeless. He's not great with money. The eldest child's very responsible. So in the will, we're leaving a bigger proportion to the eldest child because it's his turn now.
Mm.
It's a bit counterintuitive.
Or vice versa, because the youngest one needs it.
Well, that's what the court
could
will
be
say.
The other way.
Yeah, the courts will say.
Oh, really?
Because of the dependency of the youngest child, they've got a better claim on the estate. The eldest child might have been independent, doesn't need the money, and so need is one of the circumstances that they're looking at in the case of a challenged estate. So it can work against what most people think. The youngest got all that money during the lifetime, so the eldest's turn now, but it might actually work the other way.
And wow.
The youngest might have a very good shot at challenging the will and getting the bulk of the estate, which makes sense in some circumstances if you think about children that might be in circumstances of special need. where they cost more money to raise, but they're going to need more assets into the future. They can't look after themselves, they need care, or they need special premises, those sorts of things. And as much as it might be unfair, that might be what we all consider.
I guess the unfair thing coming along is also, you know, when is somebody dependent and when is a relationship in place?
Oh, gosh, yes. And, and this is one of those things where I had this conversation very recently where a person looks after their parents and they had an estranged sibling. And the parents are getting on now. And so this the client that I was talking to has been driving the parents around, takes them to the medical appointments, helps them buy their food, you know, cleans the house, all that sort of thing. And now the estranged sibling is back on the scene. And I said, I bet he's doing a lot of lawn mowing. And yep, sure enough, he's coming around and doing a few jobs and making sure he keeps a note of them and sending emails about it. And to me, it looks like this
he's setting himself up.
Yeah, he's setting himself up. He's been to a lawyer and somebody's told him, you need to get around there and prove that you've got some sort of motivation to assist and maybe some financial interdependence, maybe spend some money on the parents and get them to spend some money on you because it's going to strengthen a claim.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
surprising. It's a cutthroat business out there, isn't it?
It's a cutthroat business being in a family. you know, when there's families and money, it never ceases to amaze me how things can go off the rails.
I guess the other thing you've got to think about in wills is, like, who's going to turn off the switch?
That's a big one. So powers of attorney, that is what we're talking about there. Who's going to be in charge of making these end-of-life decisions? And so it's important to have somebody making those decisions for you. And it's another one where you might not care. And if you don't care about whether you have the life support machine switched off now or whatever, that might be a very easy decision for you. It might not be. But for your family, again, from personal experience and professional experience, I can say the family agonises about it. You know, what are we going to do if somebody's in a terminal phase of an incurable illness and we have to make a decision about ending their life? You know, it can be a really heartbreaking decision. Having somebody...
Or it could be from an accident or all sorts of things.
All sorts of things. And having somebody able to make that decision for you is very important. And that might be an attorney under a power of attorney. It might be a guardian under an enduring power of guardianship. These documents are called different things throughout the states, and it might be that it's the Advance Health Directive that might have legal effect or might not be legally binding depending on the state that you live in, but gives some indication at the very least about what your wishes are for those sorts of things. So if you feel strongly, you can prevent disputes.
From a very heartless perspective, I mean, there's a lot of financial implications by when you turn off the switch.
Oh, absolutely. I like to include in powers of attorney what I call the heartless lawyer clause, which is a clause that says before we switch granddad off, we better go down to the accountant and take some advice about it, which sounds awful, like we're balancing up the cost of keeping granddad alive for another couple of days. But the particular concern that I have is something that has come across my desk a few times where people say, we switched off granddad yesterday, what do we do today? And I have to say, well, look, you're paying a bit of tax. And generally in Australia, we don't have death duties or death taxes, but there are some de facto death taxes, and one of them is superannuation, where superannuation that's left to, for example, an adult child might be subject to tax, and it might be taxed 15% plus Medicare levy, so 16.5%, which can be substantial. And so that money may have been able to be withdrawn in grandfather's name under a power of attorney while he was alive, tax-free. But the next day when it's going to his children who are adults, it might be taxed. And that can be significant. I had a client who came to see me and was very proud that she'd sorted out her life insurance the day before with her financial planner, and she'd put $2 million worth of life insurance into superannuation. But the only beneficiary to receive it was her adult daughter, who was over 25, and so the tax was going to be round figures $600,000.
Wow.
So I saved her $600,000. And
good Lord.
She still took a few weeks to pay my bill.
So, I mean, I guess the moral of all of this chit-chat we've got going backwards and forwards, whilst it's incredibly interesting, and I mean, I know it's a morbid topic, but there's just stuff you need to know, is the fact that you need professional advice along the way. You shouldn't be going out and writing up a will on your own accord. You shouldn't be looking at, you know, taking any action without that legal understanding behind it. And you should be dealing with people who specialise in this area.
That's absolutely right. The proper advice at the right time will save a lot of money for you or for your estate. It might be you getting the privilege of paying the lawyer for the advice at this time, but it is definitely that stitch in time that will save nine.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Derek. It's been fantastic having you on here talking about this enthralling topic.
Everyone's favourite topic.
Everyone's, but it's one of those important, everyone ultimately is going to die, aren't they?
We covered death and a little bit of taxes, so yes, the two inevitabilities.
So, guys, I hope you've enjoyed that. I know it's said one of those tough topics, but it's also a topic that is really important for absolutely everybody. And, you know, we all know circumstances where justice hasn't been done simply because of ignorance, and it's one of my big bugbears, and it's why I do what I do on so many different fronts, to take the ignorance out of it so everyone's making informed decisions and are getting the results that they absolutely want. So again, thank you, Derek, for joining me, and I'll be back again to talk to everybody very, very soon on a completely different topic. So guys, watch out for the podcasts that come out. I do have them coming out on a regular basis. Make sure you subscribe to iTunes and also jump on my website, www.iloverealestate.tv. There's lots and lots of free stuff there you can go and enjoy and have a bit of a look at. And we'll see you on the next podcast. Bye for now.